Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
This hour, we're talking about Bix Beiderbecke, a cornet player from back in the 20s. Although he only had a brief career, he left an indelible mark on the world of jazz music. And I'm talking with Brendan Wolfe, who just published a new book called Finding Bix, The Life and Afterlife of a Jazz Legend. And Brendan, we just received an email from someone who is a great Bix admirer. This is from Tim. He says, I'm listening to your current conversation, and I wanted to weigh in as someone who studied music in the 21st century. I grew up on the south side of Chicago and had never heard of Bix prior to studying music at St. Ambrose University. When I moved to Davenport, I heard his music and it totally captivated me for the entirety of my time at SAU, so much so that I actually performed his song Davenport Blues on my senior recital in 2014. After all, how could I formally study trumpet in Davenport and not play some Bix? Immediately following the recital, I went down to the Bix statue on River Drive in Davenport. Even as a trumpet player studying jazz and classical music in the 21st century, everything he played seemed extremely relaxed and conversational. One of the things that was exceptionally challenging was imitating his sound by using non-traditional trumpet fingerings that he was so comfortable with as a self-taught cornet player. I just wanted to chime in and say that, as you said, even today there are musicians of all ages listening, studying, and interpreting his music. And Tim brings up a great point. I want to help people understand this thread of influence from Bix Beiderbecke. And I think most of us, when we think about famous jazz horn players, trumpeters, cornet players, of course, Louis Armstrong comes to mind first. And for a lot of people, when they look at the influence in jazz, they see sort of these twin threads of influence from Louis Armstrong and Bix Beiderbecke. Can you talk about their different influences?
Sure. I think that Bix and Lewis are really interesting juxtapositions as both musicians and people. They were just so different. Lewis was an African-American player. He was born within a year or two of Bix, but grew up in New Orleans, just outside of the red light district, raised by his mother, had no money, was often in trouble, spent a certain amount of time institutionalized. And Bix, on the other hand, was this white middle-class kid from Iowa who was raised by a strict father and just completely different upbringings. And their music, coincidentally, more than a result of that, was also completely opposite. Louis Armstrong was an absolute virtuoso on the cornet and trumpet. He could play anything. And his style of jazz seemed to be dominated by an interest in rhythm, as was jazz in general. He often played very high and flamboyantly, just as his personality was pretty flamboyant. He was a talker in a way that, and a performer in a way that Bix wasn't. Bix's horn, he kept to the middle range. He did not tend to play really high notes. He was much more melodic than Lewis was. And I think there is that sort of relaxed, laid back essence to Bix's playing that was really distinctive. Although I think it's important to say that Frank Trumbauer had that too. They're very similar stylistically.
And there are several legendary stories, possibly apocryphal, about Louis Armstrong and Bix Beiderbecke meeting, but they did know each other, right?
They were friends. Louis Armstrong claimed a couple of times, as did bandmates of his, that he and Bix had met on the river in Davenport while Lewis was playing for riverboat bands. It seems, I don't know, as likely as not that they didn't meet, but it's unclear. But what is clear is that they knew each other and they seemed to admire each other greatly, although they didn't seem to influence each other greatly. They were sort of fully formed players almost from the minute they started blowing their horns.
In very different ways. And so we see, that you can hear Louis Armstrong's influence in all kinds of jazz. But when we think about Bix Beiderbecke's influence, it really could be heard a lot in the 1950s in the cool jazz movement, right?
I think that some jazz historians have made that connection. Other folks say it's not true, and I'm not a music critic or a musicologist, so I don't want to pass myself off as an expert on this. But there is that connection to that between the way Bix was playing and this kind of like really laid back aesthetic that people later described as cool jazz.
Now, we've mentioned his addiction to alcohol, which a lot of people believe that he drank himself to death. There are people that say, no, he died of pneumonia, although it's pretty clear that these two things were interconnected. I mean, he was drinking a lot. He was having trouble getting to gigs, keeping a job when he had a job. He tried to dry up several times, and I can only imagine that in the environment that he was in, especially with what we know about addiction today, it would have been incredibly difficult to fight that kind of addiction.
I think so. I think with the kind of profession he was in and the people he was surrounded by, staying dry when you're an alcoholic would have been nearly impossible. And Bix wasn't known, at least by the comments of his friends, to have a lot of self-discipline when it came to that anyway. So and the quality of the alcohol he was drinking was very, very low. And I think it kind of and the amount he was drinking, it sort of destroyed his immune system to the point where he caught the pneumonia and it killed him.
There are these legendary stories of Bix's drinking, supposedly funny stories of, you know, things that he got into. And you do a really nice job, I think, in the book trying resisting the urge to play armchair psychiatrist, although that must have been tempting in many ways with these conflicting stories, with different accounts, with how he portrayed himself in his letters and how very different his life seemed to be to those letters. I mean, he clearly had a problem with addiction. You also, and you're not the first person to uncover this, but his sexuality was in question. While he had friends who said that, you know, there was a terrible quote, Mary, about, you know, connecting with many, many women. But
right. Yeah,
there's no evidence for that, although there is some evidence that he was not heteronormative, that he may have had relationships with men.
Well, so the evidence is he had at least a couple girlfriends, but the writer Ralph Burton, whom I mentioned earlier on, who knew Bix in 1924 and whose older brother played the drums in Bix's band, Ralph had another older brother, Gene, who was a ballet dancer. And in Burton's memoir, he describes having a conversation with Gene after Bix's death, in which Gene tells Ralph that he had a, quote, fling with Bix. He said it was no big deal, that Bix was not gay by Gene's standards, but maybe he doesn't say this, but maybe just curious, who knows. But that little bit of information has been fiercely debated and resisted ever since.
There's also this very troubling episode that is possibly what sent him off to prep school when he was 18 years old, where the report, the police record, said that it was a rainy day, and he took a young girl into a nearby garage out of the rain. She was 5 years old. And we don't really have a record of what was said or done, but it was enough that, the police were called.
That's right. Her father told the police that Bix had said something awful to her. We don't know what it was. The police charged Bix with lewd and lascivious act with this five-year-old girl, and her father gave a description of what happened. And then the next and last public record we have on the incident is that a few months later, the charges were dropped, apparently, at least according to the father, because he did not want his daughter to be forced to testify. And by this point, Bix was off to prep school at Lake Forest.
And we'll never know what really happened that day. But I think that with the evidence that you share, it's pretty clear to say that here was a man who didn't fit the norms of the society that he lived in, which adds up to a lot of anguish.
Right. I think even if you take the arrest out of the equation, the impression you get from Bix's friends, and so many of them wrote about him and wrote about him in such a distinctive way, the impression you get that's consistent across all of them is that Bix was different. Bix was odd. They were in awe of Bix. Sometimes they worked so hard to demand you to believe that Bix was normal, you felt that there's no way he could be normal. They described him as being lost in his own astronomy, or in his own private astronomy.
Right.
Or
there was being, this look that would come on his face when he was playing.
That's right, this kind of blankness. Or he was, you know, such a space cadet that he would, you know, just be on a train track and not notice that the train was coming.
Right.
So if you look at all that, Bix was clearly a really distinctive person. The arrest, whether it was true or not that he did that, it just adds to that impression that that he was different, that he didn't quite fit in, that he wasn't always quite sure how to behave.
Katie is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Katie.
Hello. Hi. I have a copied CD that I was given almost 20 years ago, and all it says on it is Bix on Piano, rare recording. A friend of mine gave it to me, and it's I was told that it's Bix Beiderbecke playing this incredibly windy, bizarre, wonderful piano piece. I wondered if you knew of the existence of a recording of him on piano, because I've kind of tried to search it out over the years and haven't come up with much.
Bix wrote a suite of piano pieces, but he only recorded one of them, and it was called In a Mist. And so that's the only known recording of Bix on piano, or at least the only one that I know of.
Well, and we have it here. Let's listen to just a few seconds of it. That's just a taste of In the Mist. And it's interesting. You write about his recording In the Mist. You write about the Davenport Blues, which Tim mentioned earlier. His original compositions seem to be constantly in flux. He did not want to be held to a composition, it seems, ever, whether it was his or anybody else's.
That's right. I think that was like a governing principle of Bix's musical life, was to constantly change and reinvent. So he refused to play any solo the same way twice. And in fact, the only reason that we have these other piano pieces that he composed is because one of his friends almost just forcibly sat him down and got him to play these things so that he could notate them. but it was difficult to get Bix to settle on one version of anything that he was playing long enough to even get it on paper.
In all of this searching that you did to find out who Bix Beiderbecke was, do you think you found him?
Oh, no. No, I don't. I think that Bix, as meticulously documented as his life is, a lot is still missing. And I think what we have are a bunch of competing voices arguing over who Bix was, whether it be his friends, his family, his biographers, historians, what have you. And Bix is like this empty vessel that we're filling up with whatever we need Bix to be.
So many people that you interacted with clearly idolize Bix Beiderbecke. There seems to be this urge that we have when there's someone whose art we admire to turn them into the person we want them to be. And it feels like people that you talked to had a really hard time with trying to think about him as a complex individual who maybe wasn't everything they wanted him to be.
I hear it all the time. Bix is simple. Bix was a simple, normal guy who played beautiful music. And I don't see him that way. And frankly, I doubt we'd be talking about him if he were so simple. But you know that's part of the empty vessel. If we need him to be simple, we can do what we need to do to make it so.
Well, the music is incredible, and his legacy is undeniable. But Brendan Wolfe, thank you so much for sharing Bix Beiderbecke with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Brendan Wolfe is the author of Finding Bix: The Life and Afterlife of a Jazz Legend. Of course, his legend and his legacy will be celebrated, as it is every summer, in Davenport, Iowa, this weekend, tomorrow through Saturday, the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival. We're going out today with another one of his songs, Way Down Yonder in New Orleans. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa. This hour, we are talking about the life and legacy of jazz legend Bix Beiderbecke. The Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival is coming up this weekend in Davenport, the 46th annual. His music, his legacy has been celebrated in Davenport, Iowa, and around the world for a very long time, in spite of his very short career. He only lived to be 28 years old and only recorded music for about 6 years. With me this hour is Brendan Wolfe. He's the author of Finding Bix, The Life and Afterlife of a Jazz Legend. And if you're a Bix fan, you're welcome to join our conversation if you'd like to weigh in on why you think his legend endures, why you think his legacy endures. We'd love to hear your thoughts. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So, Brendan, you went back to Bix's childhood to try to understand this man. And that was really your goal, to try to figure out who Bix Beiderbecke really was. Now, going back into 1903 and to the 1910s to try to figure out what somebody was like as a kid is pretty hard work, but you did find a little bit about him. Tell me what you know about his family.
He came from a middle-class family. His grandfather was a pretty wealthy German immigrant. His parents were his father owned a coal lumber business. His father was again German, and his mother was Irish.
So a mixed marriage by Davenport standards back
then. That absolutely by Eastern Iowa standards, but. you know, Bix had a pretty normal, I think, childhood, except for the fact that he was just unusually talented in music. And in fact, the local newspaper wrote a story about him when he was, I think, 7 years old, that he could play pretty much anything by ear.
On the piano.
Yeah.
Well, and his brother remembers him like laying upside down, playing the piano facing backwards.
an acrobatic musician.
A show off as a child musically. But he wasn't classically trained. I mean, he could play by ear, but he didn't really focus on learning about music, right?
Well, it's almost like he was a savant. I mean, I don't use that word in the book, but it's like the music was inside of him, and he had a perfect ear, and he played by ear, and so it took him a good chunk of his life to really learn to read music, because for much of his life, he just didn't need it. He could play what he needed to play, and that caused problems. When he was in high school, he and some friends had formed a band, and they got a great gig, but someone informed the local union that they didn't have their union card. So they were forced to go in and audition to get their union cards. And so they had to play something, and then they had to do a sight reading test. And Bix completely failed his sight reading test. In fact, the guy was playing the piano as an accompaniment to the music, and Bix just started playing what the guy was playing on piano. Just by ear. And so he couldn't get his union card then, but he was nevertheless by far the best musician.
So they lost the gig.
They did lose the gig.
Oh. Now, when did the cornet come into play? When did he start blowing his horn?
I want to say 1919. So I think he was about 16 years old, started high school, and the first recorded jazz was released in 1917. This is the 100th anniversary of that. And Bix's brother had been away in the service during World War I and come back with some jazz records. And so Bix heard those first jazz records in 1918 and started playing on the cornet soon after.
All right, and those jazz records, those original jazz records, they were what we'd call Dixieland, right?
Yeah, we would call it Dixieland now. In fact, the band was called the Original Dixieland Jazz Band. I think Dixieland, as we sort of understand it today, is something that became popular in the 1950s as a kind of throwback. Back then, in Bix's time, it was just jazz, hot jazz.
And sometimes not even called jazz, right? Just hot music.
That's right.
And he listened to this. He became enamored with it. He wanted to be a part of it. And he picked up a cornet and just started sounding it out?
Yeah. So he played along with the records. He slowed them down and he isolated the cornet line and he figured it out by ear. And he may have taken a lesson or two, but... by and large, he taught himself. He had really weird fingering as a result. So
he'd just try until he could hit the note that he wanted to hit. These are not standard fingerings like you'd learn if you joined a band and took lessons.
That's right. That's right.
Now, he played in high school. He had some success playing in high school. But then there's this very weird period that is part of the Bix legend where he got sent off to what was a preparatory school. Now, in legend, for a long time, it was thought that he was sent off to a military academy for behavior issues. Regardless of why he was sent off, and we will talk about that later on as well, it was a prep school. It was kind of a Tony boarding school, right?
That's right. Lake Forest Academy. It's still there.
And he was sent there when he was 18 years old, which kind of surprised me because that's a time when you usually think about people leaving school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think he was pretty well knew what he was about in this world, and that was music. And so I think sending him off to Lake Forest was perhaps his parents' last chance at getting Bix to buckle down a bit and pay attention to his studies and get a little discipline and see if he could make something that was a bit more mainstream out of his life. And I think most parents would have done similar. Jazz was not particularly respectable. And Bix drank a lot, just as alcohol was sort of an important part of the jazz scene at that time. And he was missing just a ton of classes. And so this was, it seems, an effort to instill some discipline.
So they sent him off to prep school close to Chicago.
Yeah.
Which was the hotbed of jazz at the moment.
Really easy for him to sneak off campus, get on a train, and play music.
Now, he did eventually get expelled from that school. And as you try to figure out who this guy was, there is a letter from his headmaster at the prep school that shed some interesting light on Bix. There's a lot of different stories about, you know, why he was expelled. There are a lot of people who just always want to believe the best of somebody with this kind of incredible talent. But the headmaster's letter is interesting. Can you tell me what it said?
Well, it was a letter to Bix's parents explaining why he had expelled their son. And it talked about the fact that it wasn't simply that Bix had snuck out of school after hours past curfew. It was also that he had snuck back with alcohol, had been distributing that alcohol to his friends, and that he had been a really bad influence on other boys.
And he also said something about how good Bix was at making clever excuses.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, one of the sources that we have to work with when we're talking about Bix Beiderbecke is his letters to his parents. And you can see from those letters that Bix is very good at deflecting, at flattering, at making the best of not the best situation. And it was clear that he used those skills on his teachers and the headmaster as well.
And when the headmaster was writing that he's clever at making excuses, he said something about it almost seems as if he believes them himself, which gives you kind of interesting insight into Bix Beiderbecke.
It really does. I think, well, you know, it's a very human quality. I think that we make the world into what we need it to be. And I think Bix did that. It did not work out for him in terms of his academic career, but I don't think that was his goal. It worked out just fine for his musical career, which he started a bit earlier than he might otherwise have. He was just, I think he liked to please people too. See the best in things rather than the worst. But it was a sort of poignant kind of observation about Bix.
I'm talking with Brendan Wolfe. He's the author of Finding Bix, The Life and Afterlife of a Jazz Legend. And we're talking this hour about Bix Beiderbecke, who originally came from Davenport, Iowa, only lived to be 28 years old, but made an indelible mark on the jazz world during his very short career. Now, after he's expelled from the prep school, what happens next?
He began playing professionally. You know, I don't have sitting in my head every band that he played for a completely perfect timeline, but
right.
he auditioned to play for the Gene Golquette Orchestra out of Detroit, and this was a big, very good traveling band, and he could not read music well enough, and his solos tended a little too much toward the hot side for the kinds of things that they were recording and making money off of. And so he missed out on that chance and did something which I think is unexpected given everything that we've talked about up to this point, which is that he came to Iowa City and he enrolled himself in the University of Iowa. And but he didn't last too long. A few weeks before, he was expelled from yet another school for getting into a drunken fist fight with a future offensive lineman for the Chicago Bears.
All right. And we've already got evidence that his drinking was out of control.
Yeah.
Obviously, being expelled from that prep school, there was evidence there. But this time at the University of Iowa also tells us that he was already having significant problems with alcohol.
There's definitely a pattern. Yes. Yes. Bix was drinking too much and it was getting him in trouble.
Now, he did connect with some really influential people during this time. And one of those people was Hoagie Carmichael, who, of course, many of us know that name, another influential musician. When did he and Hoagie meet, or how did they meet?
Well, I think that they met in Bloomington, Indiana, where, I mean, I don't know for a fact that that's where they first met, but Hoagie was in law school, but he was playing some music on the side and hanging out in a place where he would noodle on the piano for the patrons. And he and Bix met, and Hoagie became almost instantly infatuated with Bix's music. I think I told you earlier that my reaction to Bix's music was a slow burn. Not so Hoagie Carmichael. His first reaction, at least as he wrote later, was to faint onto a Davenport.
So it was so powerful that he fainted.
Yes, Hoagie.
Hoagie was a storyteller.
An exaggerator, a sentimentalist, but very entertaining storyteller.
And one of the great sources that we have for information about Bix Beiderbecke, because they became very close.
They did. Yep. Hoagie Carmichael named his son Hoagie Bix and claimed to have held on to Bix's cornet mouthpiece the rest of his life.
Kept it in his pocket.
That's right.
And one of his most famous compositions, the song Stardust, he claims was inspired by Bix Beiderbecke, right?
Yes. He says he built that tune around some sort of noodle phrase that he had heard Bix play.
And one of the most recorded and most loved songs, really, of all time. Now, as Bix was making his way in the world, I'm struck that people who met him, who heard him play, also tended to want to take care of him. That's something that he seemed to elicit in people. They saw his genius, they heard his genius, but also seemed to respond to this inability to take care of himself.
I think that's exactly right. It's one of these threads that goes through his entire life. So he became he formed a close personal and professional partnership with a saxophone player named Frank Trumbauer. And Trumbauer, I think, was a little bit younger than Bix, but sort of played the mother in that relationship and was much more mature than Bix. He was married. He was settled down in certain respects. He did not drink, or at least wasn't an alcoholic, and often just took care of Bix, got him gigs when other people weren't quite so sure that they should take a risk on this guy. And then together, they just all the best recordings have both Bix and Tram, as he was called.
Well, and it's wonderful to listen to them interact with each other. There's so much improvisation going on there, and they seem to just push each other to greater heights of creativity.
They really do. And so it's kind of sad that after Bix died, Tram never recorded anything that was of that same level. And I think that that's both a reflection of how good Bix was, but also how good they were together. And, you know, we see those kinds of musical partnerships all the time, the most obvious being like Lennon and McCartney. So Bix and Tram and Lennon and McCartney.
And this one didn't last long. We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Brendan Wolfe. He's the author of Finding Bix, The Life and Afterlife of a Jazz Legend. We're talking about Bix Beiderbecke, one of Davenport's most famous sons and a cornet player that left an indelible mark on jazz, still influencing musicians today. As we go to the break, we're going to listen to I'm Coming, Virginia.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
This hour, we're talking about Bix Beiderbecke, a cornet player from back in the 20s. Although he only had a brief career, he left an indelible mark on the world of jazz music. And I'm talking with Brendan Wolfe, who just published a new book called Finding Bix, The Life and Afterlife of a Jazz Legend. And Brendan, we just received an email from someone who is a great Bix admirer. This is from Tim. He says, I'm listening to your current conversation, and I wanted to weigh in as someone who studied music in the 21st century. I grew up on the south side of Chicago and had never heard of Bix prior to studying music at St. Ambrose University. When I moved to Davenport, I heard his music and it totally captivated me for the entirety of my time at SAU, so much so that I actually performed his song Davenport Blues on my senior recital in 2014. After all, how could I formally study trumpet in Davenport and not play some Bix? Immediately following the recital, I went down to the Bix statue on River Drive in Davenport. Even as a trumpet player studying jazz and classical music in the 21st century, everything he played seemed extremely relaxed and conversational. One of the things that was exceptionally challenging was imitating his sound by using non-traditional trumpet fingerings that he was so comfortable with as a self-taught cornet player. I just wanted to chime in and say that, as you said, even today there are musicians of all ages listening, studying, and interpreting his music. And Tim brings up a great point. I want to help people understand this thread of influence from Bix Beiderbecke. And I think most of us, when we think about famous jazz horn players, trumpeters, cornet players, of course, Louis Armstrong comes to mind first. And for a lot of people, when they look at the influence in jazz, they see sort of these twin threads of influence from Louis Armstrong and Bix Beiderbecke. Can you talk about their different influences?
Sure. I think that Bix and Lewis are really interesting juxtapositions as both musicians and people. They were just so different. Lewis was an African-American player. He was born within a year or two of Bix, but grew up in New Orleans, just outside of the red light district, raised by his mother, had no money, was often in trouble, spent a certain amount of time institutionalized. And Bix, on the other hand, was this white middle class kid from Iowa who was raised by a strict father and just completely different upbringings. And their music, coincidentally, more than a result of that, was also completely opposite. Louis Armstrong was an absolute virtuoso on the cornet and trumpet. He could play anything. And his style of jazz seemed to be dominated by an interest in rhythm, as was jazz in general. He often played very high and flamboyantly, just as his personality was pretty flamboyant, he was a talker in a way that, and a performer in a way that Bix wasn't. Bix's horn, he kept to the middle range. He did not tend to play really high notes. He was much more melodic than Lewis was, and I think there is that sort of relaxed, laid-back essence to Bix's playing that was really distinctive, although I think it's important to say that Frank Trumbauer had that too. They were very similar stylistically.
And there are several legendary stories, possibly apocryphal, about Louis Armstrong and Bix Beiderbecke meeting, but they did know each other, right?
They were friends. Louis Armstrong claimed a couple of times, as did bandmates of his, that he and Bix had met on the river in Davenport while Lewis was playing for riverboat bands. It seems, I don't know, as likely as not that they didn't meet, but it's unclear. But what is clear is that they knew each other and they seemed to admire each other greatly, although they didn't seem to influence each other greatly. They were sort of fully formed players almost from the minute they started blowing their horns.
In very different ways. And so we see, you can hear Louis Armstrong's influence in all kinds of jazz. But when we think about Bix Beiderbecke's influence, it really could be heard a lot in the 1950s in the cool jazz movement, right?
I think that some jazz historians have made that connection. Other folks say it's not true, and I'm not a music critic or a musicologist, so I don't want to pass myself off as an expert on this. But there is that connection to that between the way Bix was playing and this kind of like really laid back aesthetic that people later described as cool jazz.
Now, we've mentioned his addiction to alcohol, which a lot of people believe that he drank himself to death. There are people that say, no, he died of pneumonia, although it's pretty clear that these two things were interconnected. I mean, he was drinking a lot. He was having trouble getting to gigs, keeping a job when he had a job. He tried to dry up several times, and I can only imagine that in the environment that he was in, especially with what we know about addiction today, it would have been incredibly difficult to fight that kind of addiction.
I think so. I think with the kind of profession he was in and the people he was surrounded by, staying dry when you're an alcoholic would have been nearly impossible. And Bix wasn't known, at least by the comments of his friends, to have a lot of self-discipline when it came to that anyway. So and the quality of the alcohol he was drinking was very, very low. And I think it kind of and the amount he was drinking, it sort of destroyed his immune system to the point where he caught the pneumonia and it killed him.
There are these legendary stories of Bix's drinking, supposedly funny stories of, you know, things that he got into. And you do a really nice job, I think, in the book, resisting the urge to play armchair psychiatrist, although that must have been tempting in many ways, with these conflicting stories, with different accounts, with how he portrayed himself in his letters and how very different his life seemed to be to those letters. I mean, he clearly had a problem with addiction. You also, and you're not the first person to uncover this, but his sexuality was in question. While he had friends who said that, you know, there was a terrible quote, Mary, about, you know, connecting with many, many women. But
right. Yeah,
there's no evidence for that, although there is some evidence that he was not heteronormative, that he may have had relationships with men.
Well, so the evidence is he had at least a couple girlfriends, but the writer Ralph Burton, whom I mentioned earlier on, who knew Bix in 1924 and whose older brother played the drums in Bix's band. Ralph had another older brother, Gene, who was a ballet dancer. And in Burton's memoir, he describes having a conversation with Gene after Bix's death, in which Gene tells Ralph that he had a, quote, fling with Bix. He said it was no big deal, that Bix was not gay by Gene's standards, but maybe he doesn't say this, but maybe just curious, who knows. But that little bit of information has been fiercely debated and resisted ever since.
There's also this very troubling episode that is possibly what sent him off to prep school when he was 18 years old, where the report, the police record said that it was a rainy day and he took a young girl into a nearby garage out of the rain. She was 5 years old, and we don't really have a record of what was said or done, but it was enough that the police were called.
That's right. Her father told the police that Bix had said something awful to her. We don't know what it was. The police charged Bix with lewd and lascivious act with this five-year-old girl, and her father gave a description of what happened. And then the next and last public record we have on the incident is that a few months later, the charges were dropped, apparently, at least according to the father, because he did not want his daughter to be forced to testify. And by this point, Bix was off to prep school at Lake Forest.
And we'll never know what really happened that day. But I think that with the evidence that you share, it's pretty clear to say that here was a man who didn't fit the norms of the society that he lived in, which adds up to a lot of anguish.
Right. I think even if you take the arrest out of the equation, the impression you get from Bix's friends, and so many of them wrote about him and wrote about him in such a distinctive way, the impression you get that's consistent across all of them is that Bix was different. Bix was odd. They were in awe of Bix. Sometimes they worked so hard to demand you to believe that Bix was normal, you felt that there's no way he could be normal. They described him as being lost in his own astronomy, or in his own private astronomy.
Right.
Or
there was this look that would come on his face when he was playing.
That's right, this kind of blankness. Or he was, you know, such a space cadet that he would, you know, just be on a train track and not notice that the train was coming.
Right.
So if you look at all that, Bix was clearly a really distinctive person. The arrest, whether it was true or not that he did that, it just adds to that impression that he was different, that he didn't quite fit in, that he wasn't always quite sure how to behave.
Katie is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Katie.
Hello. Hi. I have a copied CD that I was given almost 20 years ago, and all it says on it is Bix on Piano, Rare Recording. A friend of mine gave it to me, and it's I was told that it's Bix Beiderbecke playing this incredibly windy, bizarre, wonderful piano piece. I wondered if you knew of the existence of a recording of him on piano, because I've kind of tried to search it out over the years and haven't come up with much.
Bix wrote a suite of piano pieces, but he only recorded one of them, and it was called In a Mist. And so that's the only known recording of Bix on piano, or at least the only one that I know of.
Well, and we have it here. Let's listen to just a few seconds of it. that's just a taste of In the Mist. And it's interesting. You write about his recording In the Mist. You write about the Davenport Blues, which Tim mentioned earlier. His original compositions seem to be constantly in flux. He did not want to be held to a composition, it seems, ever, whether it was his or anybody else's.
That's right. I think that was like a governing principle of Bix's musical life, was to constantly change and reinvent. So he refused to play any solo the same way twice. And in fact, the only reason that we have these other piano pieces that he composed is because one of his friends almost just forcibly sat him down and got him to play these things so that he could notate them. But it was difficult to get Bix to settle on one version of anything that he was playing long enough to even get it on paper.
In all of this searching that you did to find out who Bix Beiderbecke was, do you think you found him?
Oh, no. No, I don't. I think that Bix, as meticulously documented as his life is, a lot is still missing. And I think what we have are a bunch of competing voices arguing over who Bix was, whether it be his friends, his family, his biographers, historians, what have you. And Bix is like this empty vessel that we're filling up with whatever we need Bix to be.
So many people that you interacted with clearly idolize Bix Beiderbecke. There seems to be this urge that we have when there's someone whose art we admire to turn them into the person we want them to be. And it feels like people that you talked to had a really hard time with trying to think about him as a complex individual who maybe wasn't everything they wanted him to be.
I hear it all the time. Bix is simple. Bix was a simple, normal guy who played beautiful music. And I don't see him that way. And frankly, I doubt we'd be talking about him if he were so simple. But you know that's part of the empty vessel. If we need him to be simple, we can do what we need to do to make it so.
Well, the music is incredible, and his legacy is undeniable. But Brendan Wolff, thank you so much for sharing Bix Beiderbecke with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Brendan Wolff is the author of Finding Bix: The Life and Afterlife of a Jazz Legend. Of course, his legend and his legacy will be celebrated, as it is every summer, in Davenport, Iowa this weekend, tomorrow through Saturday, the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival. We're going out today with another one of his songs, Way Down Yonder in New Orleans. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.